All right. Well, welcome. Thank you so much, Teresa, for doing this interview with me and for my community. I've known you now for many years, and I think you're one of the best trauma experts in the in the States, or at least in Florida. We did an interview already a few years ago. It's on YouTube, and you explained to my community how you explain what RAD is, and it was such an amazing video for the parents. So maybe first, but they don't know you. It's just a video, so maybe it's nice where you can introduce yourself and what do you do different from regular therapists? I know it, but my community doesn't know. So maybe it's nice if you introduce yourself and what makes you one of the best therapists in the States.
Oh, I appreciate that. Thank you so much. And I enjoy so much being here. We don't get to talk nearly enough, so we should.
I know.
But I missed you. My name is Teresa Girard. I am a licensed mental health counselor here in the state of Florida. I've been in practice for, since 2000, so 18, 19 years now. I've been working exclusively with attachment disorders since 2003. What makes attachment disorder different? Working with children with attachment disorder, and this is why the reason why I work with this population exclusively, is because children with RAD have a different mindset. Their belief system is different from a normal, typical, whatever you want to call the children that don't have early life trauma to the extent that these kids have. And because of their early life experiences, they have developed a belief system that says, I trust no one. The world is a dangerous place, so I have to be in control of everyone and everything in order to feel safe. And there's something inherently wrong with me that my birth mother didn't love and take care of me. So with that belief system, they're thought process, their decision-making process becomes, I can do whatever I have to do to get what I want, regardless of the consequences to myself or others. So when you're working with someone that has that thought process, that has that belief system, you have to interact and relate to them differently than you would relating to a child that believes, I trust my parents, I trust the authority figures in my life, the world is safe as long as I follow the rules and do what I'm told, and that I'm special and I'm important. So that is the mindset of normal, typically raised children versus the mindset of children with early life trauma.
And how come you know about this and like regular aides, as like in Holland, they have good intentions, but they don't really get it? How come?
That's one of the, not the scariest, but the most frustrating things for me. The reason I know about this, I didn't learn about it in my training. I have a master's degree in mental health. It was never mentioned any more than any other diagnosis in, over here we have the DSM-5, which is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Health. And I don't think real highly of that document, but we won't get into that. So you don't get trained for it in your general education. The reason I got trained was because I met a family that had adopted a sibling group of three. And this was shortly after I had graduated, and I was going through a divorce, and I had two children. It was almost Christmas time. I needed money. And so I was at my supervision, and the supervisor said, we just got a call in from a caseworker that has a family that's about to dissolve their adoption if we don't get someone in there and address the problem real quick. Well, there were three kids. You got paid more money for doing assessments than you did for doing therapy. So I said, I'll go because I needed money for Christmas. So I go into this home, and there are three children, the oldest of which is this little strawberry blonde freckled 9-year-old girl, adorable, who was as schizophrenic and serious RAD issues. So I spent 3 hours talking with the mom, and in the meantime of all that, She actually had a meltdown, and mom asked me if I would help her to restrain her to keep the household safe. What had triggered the call to the caseworker saying we need help now was that that 9-year-old little girl had attacked mom with a butcher knife and left over 400 stab marks between the bedroom and bathroom. Fortunately, mom was more agile than the child, and an older sibling was able to call 911. Two police officers, sofa cushions, and a can of mace were needed to subdue this 9-year-old little girl. So I spent the 3 hours that I spent there with the mom, I spent getting educated. That was my introduction to attachment disorder. So there were two little brothers, and I knew this. I ain't working with her because she is just way too scary to me. I don't know enough. I'm not even going to pretend I know enough. I will refer her to a therapist with more experience than me, but I can work with those two little guys. And so I left the home. I went back a week later to do the assessment on the children, the two little boys. And I spent another 3 or 4 hours there with mom, getting educated by the mom. And by the, at the course of that conversation, she asked me if I would be willing to go to Colorado with them, because that was their goal for their daughter, to go to Colorado for what's called a 2-week intensive with some of the best people in the country that worked with that population. As it turned out, I never went back into that home at that time, because when the other therapist went in to work with the daughter, she got violent again. And the therapist said, this is too dangerous. We can't do this. Mom closed the case. And that was it. So, but I was curious. My curiosity had been piqued. I started doing some research. In fact, I did a lot of research. I read a lot of books. I looked for, well, I didn't do that yet, but I was reading and I was going to trainings. 6 months later, I was sitting at home reading a book that was written by the gentleman, Levy. What's his first name?
Peter Levy.
No, Levy, L-E-V-Y. He's out in Colorado. I don't know why his name won't come to me, but it won't right now. But anyway, he had written a book. And in that book, Nancy Thomas had written a chapter. So I'm laying in bed on a Saturday morning reading this chapter. And I get about a page and a half into the chapter. And I've got this, I felt like I was going to throw up. I was like nauseous. And I put the book down. I'm thinking, what is going on? And as I'm reading this book, it's like, oh my gosh, everything she's saying about how you have to raise these children is the exact opposite of everything I believe about how you raise the children. I have two kids, two girls. My parenting strategy has always been, you make them as independent as possible as soon as possible. And here she's saying these kids have to ask permission to go to the bathroom, and if we could make them ask permission to breathe, we would. And that just was this conflict inside of me, and I'm thinking, these people are nuts. So I didn't look at another thing attachment-based from that period until 6 months after that. So now it's a year after I had met this family. And I have to tell you, I told her I would go to Colorado. The reason I told her I'd go to Colorado was because I wanted to go skiing. That's where the mountains are. The highest point in Florida is 113 feet above sea level. So to go to the mountains, I wanted to go. Mm-hmm. So anyway, a year after that initial meeting, I get a phone call. I come home from work. There's a message on my machine. It's this mom. Therese, I don't know if you remember me or not, but this is Donna. We've got the money. We're going to Colorado next week. Are you still willing to go with us? Well, it was February again. There's lots of snow in the mountains in Colorado. And I really wanted to go to Colorado more than I was concerned about these people being crazy, okay? So on the plane, on the way out to Colorado, I picked a book up that I had bought at some point. It was sitting on my bookshelf. I love books, as you can tell. It was written by Daniel Hughes. It was called Building the Bonds of Attachment. Excellent, excellent book. I would recommend it to anybody. It's written as a story, so it's a quick read, easy read, because I'm a slow reader. I get on this plane to Colorado. By the time I get to Colorado and into the next day, I had finished reading that book, and now I understood why Nancy Thomas recommends to parent the way she does. It made sense to me. All of the pieces fell into place, and it was like, okay, I can understand that. And it makes sense to me why you would do that. It's still completely different from what I do, but I can understand why you would do that. So I went out on a Saturday, finished the book on Sunday. Monday morning, I drive up to Evergreen, Colorado, which was an hour drive because I was staying in Denver. And I get to Terry Levy, that's his name, Terry. And Mike Orleans used to work with him, but he has since passed. But anyway, I get to their office and I tell them, I got there before the family did. I said, I got to tell you, I'm not sure that I believe in any of this stuff that you do, but I'm curious. And they said, okay, no problem. You hang out with us for the next 2 weeks and we'll talk at the end. I'm like, okay, that's cool. And they gave me lots of tapes that I could listen. Yeah, cassette tapes. That's how long ago this was. That I could plug into the car and listen to when I drove back and forth to Denver. So we ended up going back a second time for the two boys. And the second time that we were there, Terry Levy made the comment to the family. He said, if you really want to help your family, you'll leave the state of Florida because there's no one in Florida that does attachment work. So my light bulb went off and I went, oh, but I'm in Florida. That would leave an exclusive market for me if I got expertise in this field. So then I did a year-long training on top of the 4 weeks I had spent with Terry and Mike and on top of all the research that I had done on my own. That's how I came to know what I know.
Wow.
Long answer to a short
question. What did I ask again? Yeah, it's hard to find the right knowledge and then actually to believe it and to start it.
Here is my frustration with other therapists out there. They have the best of intentions and they will go to one of these 6-hour trainings or a 2-day training that will explain to you what RAD is and what your goal is in healing it. But they don't get any experience and they have an intellectual understanding. Yeah. But they don't grasp that major concept that their mindset of these children is different than that of normal children. So they go in thinking that I'll just build a relationship with this child and then that will help them heal, which works for normal and typical children. However, with a RAD child, they're not capable of making relationships. They've been living with this family that has provided their every need for how many years, and they don't trust those people. You think you're going to build a relationship with them in an hour once a week?
Yeah,
it's crazy thinking. And the child uses that therapist as a tool to hurt the family. Because what happens is the child and the therapist now have an alliance, and the child starts making the mom the bad guy. So now the therapist is aligning with the child in their pathology to do further damage in the family. And unless the therapist, they don't know what they don't know. And that is the problem.
Yeah, that's because I have like a big community in Holland, and the frustration of the parents, mostly the mother, is so major sometimes.
Yeah, because the mother's targeted, because that's what RAD is all about. That child is reacting to that pathological relationship between the child and the birth child. Well, our mind does not distinguish time, place, or people. So it's blaming this mom in this role for what this person did back here without just differentiating that these are two completely different people. You don't have to protect yourself from this person because this is not the person that did the damage to you. The child can't distinguish between the two.
And also what happens, and you taught me in at Healing Hearts Camp, in the beginning they have the social nice behavior. You call it the honeymoon. So in the beginning, it's sweet and nice and, how was your holiday? And
Yeah, we call that superficially charming and engaging. And people outside of the family will just rave about how polite and wonderful your children are when you take them out in public. And then go home and say, see, it's just you because everyone else thinks I'm wonderful and it's just you. There's something. And it's pure and total manipulation.
Yeah, that's good because I told my community, I was talking to you today, and I asked them to ask questions, if they have questions for you. And one of the questions was about the mask. The mom calls it the mask. Where is it? There's a question of a mother. How do I deal with the many masks that my foster parent is using? How can I recognize her between the mask and the real her? Can you answer that question?
Are you talking about the child? The child wears these masks.
The foster daughter is using the mask and the mother has a hard time recognizing the real her or the mask.
Well, you're going to get the mask most of the time. Just because it's a defense mechanism. And that's the other piece. You have to understand these children do the things they do through no fault of their own. And by that, I mean they were damaged. Having been in the environment that they were in early on in their life, they had no alternative but to develop these defense mechanisms in order to survive. So now that they're in a safe environment, it's like I said, they don't differentiate time and place. They're still operating from those defense mechanisms that were necessary and in their mind saved their life back in the early days. So in their mind now, they think if I give up these masks, if I give up all of my defensive strategies, I could die. Because they can't get outside of themselves to the point that they can see that they're in a safe and loving environment right now. It's not safe enough for them to step out of those defense mechanisms to experience what safety is.
And is it that they don't want to, or is it that they don't know how to?
They don't know how to. They're clueless about how to do that. And in order to do it, they have to have trust. And trust doesn't come easy. This is why I do the camps with Nancy Thomas. This next one will be our 20th camp.
So 20th? We've been
20th. So we've been working together for a really long time. And how what Nancy always says, the healing path is you start, the child first has to respect you. Because if they don't respect you, if they can walk all over you, if they can manipulate you, then you're weak and they're more powerful. And because they're more powerful, they can't give up any control because you're not strong enough to keep them safe. So first off, you have to establish respect. The child has to be able to respect you, meaning that they cannot pull any of their crap with you and get away with it. And what this looks like when I get kids that come into my office, when I work with them, you know, they may bring up something like, I had peas and carrots for dinner last night. I have no idea if they had peas and carrots for dinner last night. That's a test for me. Because if I say, oh, really, how were they? And they actually had corn and potato.
Yeah.
They're going to look at me like, oh, you don't know nothing. And yeah. I'm going to walk all over you and you can't help me because you're too weak because I can manipulate you. Yeah. So nobody expects me to know what they had for dinner last night. And there's, you just can't know everything. So when a child makes a statement like that, my response to them is just, did I ask you what you had for dinner last night? And now I have established that I'm not falling for your games. And that puts me up to a level that they don't often run into. Because this child, the defense mechanism you're talking about being superficially charming and engaging, is their way of going in and figuring out if, you know, who's got the power in this situation? What do I need to do? Can I get them aligned with me? Can I use them? With these kids, relationships are tools to accomplish their goals. The emotional connection is they are clueless about anything about that. To them, it's just you're a tool to be used. Can I use you? when I answer with a statement like, did I ask you what you had for dinner? They have to step back and think, oh my gosh, she might be someone I can trust. She'll have to pass a few more tests, and I can start to respect her now with the possibility that down the line I could trust her. So that's what that superficially charming and engaging is all about, is I need to learn about the people around me, and I'm going to do it by, you know, giving them what they want so I can see who they are and how they respond.
And then when we go back to the mother, how do I, or maybe that's not the question from the mother, but maybe my question, how can the mother heal the daughter so she doesn't have to show the masks? Maybe it starts with trust.
It's really hard to heal these kids without the help of a therapist.
Yeah.
Just so you know, especially if you've got a child that's more severe. If you've got a more severe, the more severe your child is, the more expertise your therapist has to have. So it's really difficult for, as a mom, but what you can start with, this is, again, why I do the camps and have done so many of them, because the camp is all about teaching the parents how to set up the environment of the home. How to in a healing environment. It just said our internet connection is unstable. I hope you can still hear me. But that home environment has to be one that supports that respect, building into trust, building into love. And so there's certain things we have to do in order to, number one, help that child respect us. Number two, to help that child learn to trust. And that's what you can do is just don't address the behaviors the child engages in. You have to address the thing that's driving the behaviors, which is usually a sense of danger and a lack of feeling safe. So when the child does that phony baloney stuff, that's what we call it. When they do the phony baloney stuff, you just say, wow, that seemed kind of fake and phony. Is there something bothering you? Are you worried about something? Because I want you to know you're safe. You're home and you're safe, and I am plenty strong enough to take care of you and make sure you get what you need. We always distinguish the difference between wants and needs. My job as your parent is to make sure that all of your needs are met, not your wants. Wants are what you perceive as important. Needs are what I know are important. And so I would address it as a parent from a place of helping the child understand that they're safe and they don't need to use those strategies.
I think if people are going to listen to this later, it feels like Olympic parenting. It's so nuts how we are raised ourselves, and I know you for a couple of years now, and I know how to do it, and sometimes I fail completely, but to explain this to the people I help in Holland is so hard, because very often I feel like the parents are parenting from guilt a little bit, because they already have such a hard time. Oh, now I have to be strict. And
it's not guilt, it's pity. And pity is so, so dangerous, because you're feeling sorry for the kid, so you don't hold them accountable. And I tell people, there's this fine edge on the sword. And on one side, you've got that you have to understand that the child does what they do through no fault of their own. It's the result of their experiences, which they did not have control over. On the other side, you have to hold them accountable for the choices that they make. So they have this belief system that drives these behaviors, and we have to understand the belief system, but we hold them accountable for the choices that they make as a result of that belief system. So we understand, and when you understand why they do it, then you can usually keep the anger out of it, and hopefully the frustration as well in addressing those behaviors. Because if you just keep reminding yourself, it's not my child's fault that these are the decisions, that these behaviors even occur to them. That's a result of what happened. But the fact that he made this choice, he needs to know it's not a good choice, and he needs to be held accountable for that choice.
I thought of something when I want to explain it. What I found out is that, like, I have my own, like, mascot. I call it attachment monster. So okay. All the time I explain the parents or the people that I help is that you have the child and then you have the attachment monster. So when they show that behavior, I always tell them it's not them, not their authentic self, but it's the attachment monster. And we need to like especially when the children are a little bit younger, we need to I don't know the words in English, but we need to together to fight against the monster and then heal your heart.
Yeah.
Especially young children. I used it also in my daughter, Jasmine. When I told her when she was young, it's not you who is showing the bad behavior. It's the attachment monster. And together we're going to fight against the monster and heal it. She was like, And it was a really nice way to teach them. They feel really bad. The children feel really bad.
Oh, yeah. When I work with kids, the first thing I do with them is explain to them what attachment is, which is the other YouTube.
Yeah.
And we talk about a control monster.
Oh, yeah.
With babies that are raised in a healthy environment, they come out of the womb and then mom and dad start filling them with love. And so their heart opens up just like a flower. And then, of course, by the time they're about 7-8 months old, they can start giving love back to mom and dad. So love's coming in, love's going out. With these kids, what happens is they come out of the womb, but they're in an environment that is not safe. So it starts to open up, but then what I call the control monster comes and grabs hold of that little baby heart and says, little bitty baby, do not worry. We're here to protect you. And the control monster is made up of all their sad, mad, and scared that are all the emotions that result from that environment. That mad, sad, and scared come and grab hold of the little baby heart and say, don't worry. We're going to get you through this. You will survive and we'll make sure of it. So, of course, they get through the environment. Now they get into this wonderful adoptive home. And now this mom and dad are pouring all this love into this baby, but it can't get there because of the control monster. When I'm explaining this, we still call it all the mad, sad, and scared. All the mad, sad, and scared is stopping that heart from receiving all that love that's being given. So what we need to do is make that mad, sad, and scared kind of melt away so the heart can start to open up to receive the love. And that mad, sad, and scared is what we call the control monster.
Oh, yeah. Nice. I have another question from a mother. She has 1,001 questions for you, but we'll handle a few tonight. I hear that all the time. How do you handle aggression? I know when I help parents or families, especially when they are connected already to government care, that they have such a, in my eyes, wrong opinion about looking at the aggression part. It's like, this is bad, unsafe, and it's not supposed to be there. You and Nancy taught me, no, it's their way of letting the trauma out. And but still, I explain it to the parents, but then still it's there. So how can we handle aggression? I think it starts first with the mindset, looking at it in a different way.
Well, yeah.
But how, that's the question that the mother is, how do you handle aggression?
Well, and what we do here, and I have the luxury of having a respite worker that I work with. And when my clients get aggressive, like just last week, I had a mom called me up, the little boy, 8 years old, nope, he's probably 7, hit mom in the back of the head because his brother would not share his gummy worms with him.
Oh.
And so mom calls me and says, Therese, what do we do? And I said, he makes the trip to Miss B's house and what had happened was he had gotten away with hitting the siblings. So for him, it wasn't a big stretch to move it up to hitting mom, but we have zero tolerance for aggression against parents. So he went and spent about a week at Miss B's house.
Maybe we have to explain Miss B because I know who she is, but.
Yeah, Miss B is a therapeutic motivational respite provider. And when kids go to Miss B's house, they do a lot of chores, they do a lot of sitting, they do a lot of journaling. And the goal of Miss B's house is to teach children respect for their parents and self-control. And so they will sit for, and you'd be, she has a presence about herself, as you know. And you can walk into her house, and she'll have 15 children all there because they have been misbehaving at home, and you can hear a pin drop in her house. I wish we had a million of her.
Yeah, I know.
Just one more of her. But we don't. But you need to find one over there in your neck of the woods.
Yeah.
Because that, I mean, this little boy won't hit his mom again. Because he now knows that if he makes that choice, the consequence of it is something he doesn't really want to do. Or he really doesn't want to do. So that's what we do with aggression. Now, the mindset behind that, what the mom has to keep in mind is, and it backs up, if she had been more diligent about addressing it when he was being violent with the siblings, it would not have escalated to the point that he's being violent with the parents. If you've got a child that's already violent, you can't match violence with violence. You can't, physical punishment will not work on these kids. Physical punishment with these kids just teaches them that their belief system is exactly correct. See, she abuses me. She is not safe. I don't want to be around her because she's going to hurt me. And it triggers all that trauma from the past. So physical, if it worked, we'd be all over it. But it doesn't work, and it makes the child worse. And now they can't trust you. It's done huge damage to your relationship with the child. So when a child is being violent, the goal is to separate the child from the area. Just get them out of the home. You have to, number one priority is to keep everyone safe. So you've got to get the child either in a room or get everybody else out of the room where the child is. I'm not going to advocate physical restraint, but we do use that at camp because the child has to regain control of themselves. And what I tell the kids is you are the boss of your body. It is your job to be a good boss of your body. If you are not able to be a good boss of your body, I will help you out by becoming the boss of your body until you are able to take on that responsibility again. And that works for me. And when I've got control of the child's body, then I wait until they're calm. And I can tell they're calm because I will ask them any question. And if they respond with answering the question and saying, "Miss Teresa," or I'll just say, "Are you ready to be the boss of your body?" And they say, "Yes, Miss Teresa," because that's how they refer to me. Then I will slowly give them control back of their body. I will, you know, "I'm going to give you this hand and you show me that you can control this hand. And you're going to show me that because I'm going to lay it right here and I want it to stay here. Your job is to keep your hand right here where I tell you to do it." So we're testing for, is he listening or she listening to me? And are they controlling, are they being compliant? Are they doing what they're told? Because if they can be compliant and follow directions, then they're ready to be the boss of their body again. If your child is too big for you to safely control them, you cannot use this strategy. Because if you, here in the United States, we are very diligent about child abuse. And child abuse here is defined, if you leave a mark on that child's body, then you can be found guilty of child abuse. So we stay away from that stuff. And we are always, always, always thinking about how do we keep this child safe? So if the child is as big as you or bigger, if you can't safely control their body, then you need to put them in an area where they can't hurt anybody until they get themselves to that place where they can control their body.
Like the intervention room at the Healing Arts Camp.
Exactly.
It's a nice place. Eh? I always tell the parents, see if you can find a room or like a certain part in the house where you can, yeah, create an intervention place or room.
Yeah.
Okay. And yeah, that's another question you hear all the time. How can you handle the stealing and the lying?
Stealing and lying. When a child lies to me and you just assume that they're lying, this is my strategy and why clients get so frustrated with me, because they will tell me something and I have a relationship with them, meaning that I've worked with them for a while. And when they tell me something, and I will say to them, you know, I'm not so sure that I believe that. And I will say to them, why do you think I don't believe that? And they will tell me 10 times out of 10, 100 times out of 100, they will say, because I lie. And I'm like, right. So you could be lying to me. And so because I don't know if you are or not, I'm just going to assume that you are. And I will be the one that decides if I'm going to believe you or not. Now, the more you tell me the truth, the better your chances are that I will believe you when something really important comes up. But in the meantime, you've told me this. I so much would love to be able to believe you, but right now I just don't. So that's what it is.
That's how you handle
it. It's me taking control. They lie to have control, because when they're lying to you, or if they're telling the truth, they're the only ones that know. And to them, that's a control and manipulation stuff, which goes back to those self-protective defense mechanisms. And they are in control. So by saying, I'm going to choose if I believe you or not, puts me in control of their lies. Yeah. And that again goes back to that respect thing. Now they can respect me because they can't manipulate and lie to me. The stealing. There's lots of different strategies for that. The original family that got me into doing this work, they came up with a strategy for stealing, and there were a sibling group of three. So whenever someone stole from another sibling, the victim sibling got to take whatever they wanted from the offending sibling. And dollar value, all this, nothing mattered. If you take something from me, I get to take something from you. And it got to the point where they had lost a lot of their good stuff as consequences for behavior. So Christmas was a really interesting time for that family. Birthdays, very interesting time. The siblings were like, oh, goody, what comes because you owe me three? Kinds of things. What Nancy recommends is when a child steals something, they have to pay restitution equal to twice the value of whatever it was that they stole. If they steal cash, if they steal $20, they owe mom and dad $40 worth of chores. If they steal something from a sibling, they owe restitution to that sibling. Another strategy Nancy has that's really good is that she hides a few little trinkets around the house. And then she tells the child, I have hidden some things around this house that I know that you would really like to have. And I just want you to know that if you find them and steal them, you're going to owe me restitution for twice the value of what you found. But I also want you to know that I put them there with love and I want you to have them. These children will do the exact opposite of what you tell them to do. So now when they find something they want to steal, in the back of their mind, they're thinking, ooh, is this one of those things that she hid from me? And I'm not going to give her the satisfaction of taking it because it's got love in it. Mm. So, and that works very well as well.
I know that from experience. That was one of the things I started doing in the house, and also the chores. I found out that doing the chores, it gave me power as a parent, power back to, like, I could leave the old parenting, and the preaching, being patient, blah, 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 and going into, okay, no problem. You can keep doing that. You can keep doing, but then you have the chores. And I had to write them down because I couldn't remember them all. It was such a shift in parenting, and it gave me my power back, and it gave me a tool to stay sane in a way.
Well, and not only does that help the parent, but it helps the child, because now when the child's doing this chores, they're contributing to the family. They feel like they're accomplishing something and they're doing something positive. So it's building that self-esteem at the same time that they're paying their restitutions. And that's hugely valuable, because remember that third belief is I'm nobody, I'm bad. And now we're starting to build in them a sense of pride in themselves because they do their chores well. Mm-hmm. They're contributing to the family.
Yeah, exactly. Also, like, because I'm studying the work of Bruce Perry all the time, and he also talks about, yeah, we used to live in tribes. We used to be more like, yeah, more close family, and everything is so divided or separated. Like, we used to wash cars together. So we used to do the gardens together, but now we have it all, like, car wash, gardener, and doing the chores together makes the children feel part of a tribe again, eh?
Yes.
It's so important. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Thank you. Let me see if I can find another kind of question. Yeah, I don't know if that's, let me see, how can I? This is maybe also a good question. It's from a therapist. She went to my trainings and my inspiration days about attachment. So she's like a person who understands. And she said, I'm helping an adolescent with attachment issues, but his surroundings are not safe. So where he lives is just so unsafe. Do I make any sense? I mean, can I give him something to hold on to if his personal space and life is so unsafe?
That's a really, really tough one. And that's part of why I don't work within the foster care system, because by doing attachment work, what you're doing is you're taking away the child's defense mechanisms. And if they're still in an environment that's not safe, they still need those defense mechanisms. So the work you would do with a therapist, you don't want to take away their defense mechanisms because they still need them, but you can work on improving that child's value, that sense of self that says you're an important person. That's not okay that your environment's like that. How can we help you to still survive in that environment, mm-hmm. but realize your value and your importance in this world?
Wow, that's such a good one. I didn't think about that.
Yeah.
It's sometimes still needed when the private life is not safe or the surroundings are not safe. Ooh, wow.
Right.
I hope she's going to listen to this interview. This is also a question from a mother. Do traumatized kids always have a lower social and emotional development during childhood? If yes, and why is that?
Attachment children are usually behind the curve in development because, remember that belief system, I can't trust anyone, so I can't learn anything. I can't trust anyone, so my relationships don't exist. They're all very one-sided where I'm in control. There's no reciprocity in their relationships because they didn't learn that stuff during those critical times to learn it when they're young. So they have to learn that stuff before they can have successful social interactions and relationships with peers, teachers, other adults. Now they can do the phony thing really well. So, and it's so funny because these kids, I just had this experience with a 14-year-old not long ago. All my friends at school, you know, I have all these great friends and I don't want to, she ended up moving homes and she's telling me how distraught she is that she's losing her friends, not to mention the family that she's been living with. But so I asked her about these friends. Well, tell me about your friends. Well, she had three of them and she could tell me their name. Well, what are their last names? She could tell me one last name. I said, does she have any brothers or sisters? No clue. No clue. And the interesting thing about this was that one of the siblings in her home was in the same grade, in a lot of the same classes, and she could report back to us the interactions and the relationships and what this child was perceiving as these dear close friends that she can't afford to leave were not that at all, and were basically using her in her, you know, and it was a very warped sense of what relationships and friends are. Mm. And that happens real often because they've never developed those social skills.
Yeah. Well, that touches my heart a little bit because my daughter has a really hard time making friendships with the same age. When she goes with older or adults, she does a lot better than with her own age. For some reason, she loses herself, and now she's in the age of finding boys, and then it gets complicated.
Well, and they're usually much better with younger kids too. And depending on their age, how much younger, because their emotional development is always delayed. Yeah. So the 14-year-old could probably relate pretty well to 9 and 10-year-olds, but she just doesn't have the skills to be with age mates, to engage with age mates.
And do you think that will, because we're doing all the work we can, and I am really, I have a lot of knowledge, you know, I do make mistakes also, but I'm doing the best I can, and we have a really trauma-informed family here at home. Do you think she will, when she gets older, the gap will become closer?
What I tell my parents is I said right around the time the child gets to their mid to late 20s is usually, because our brains are developing up until they say now age 27, 28. So you've got that time frame for things to get caught up. And it's usually parents of children that have attachment problems. My experience has been when the kids get to 25 to 30, they'll come back and say, oh my gosh, I can't believe all the things I did to you and how awesome you were even through all of my crap. And I cannot thank you enough for hanging in there with me because I know I was horrible. But it's usually those mid to late 20s before they get to that place.
I'm going to take my brain. This is a brain that I found. Do you know this brain? I always tell the parents that I'm teaching, like, here's the brain stem and here is the
cortex.
Yeah, I don't know in English. Cortex? Neocortex? Yeah. It takes like 25 years to grow it. Eh?
Yep.
And then I think the people who are listening to you now, it gives them hope. It gives them really hope that just because sometimes they feel so hopeless, like, yeah, should I put them out of the home? I don't know anymore. I take care so much. I do so much.
And sometimes the child does need to be outside of the home. And this Miss B's got kids in her home that they had just created such chaos in the home environment that the home had become so dysfunctional that you have to pull the kid out because the dysfunctional home cannot help the dysfunctional child. This going back to that very first question you asked me, what's the difference between normal kids versus attachment disorder kids and working with them? With normal and typical children, the theory is you take a disturbed child, put them into a healthy home, and the child becomes healthy.
Yeah.
With attachment disorder, you take a disturbed child, you put them into a healthy home, and the home becomes disturbed. That's the power of the child. Yeah. And sometimes it's gotten so you have to get the kid out to save the family. And the goal is for the child to be reunified when both parts are healthy again. But that's really difficult to do because it's just difficult because what happens, the child can change out here. If the environment does not change to have an understanding of the child and change how they parent and relate to that child, if you take the child out and the child heals, but the home stays the same, when you put the child back in the home, the child's going to go back right to their old behaviors because they cannot be stronger than the environment. And the environment hasn't made the changes needed to match the changes the child has made. and it just blows up again in no time.
Yeah. Well, that's why I believe in the intensives, eh? Or you go with the whole family to, or Nancy, right, to another place, or to the Healing Arts Camp, because I still think that this is the best kickstart you can have.
Yeah.
But if that's not possible, the one-on-one, like the intensive, where you have me, you, or Nancy in your home, and we know other people who do that too, like Karen from Canada, that is the best thing you can have, because even if as a mother or a family, you are really... you have good intentions, you don't see your own blind spots. And I see that when I observe the family, you see it within no time what the blind spots are in the family, even when they're really well intent. Because I always tell my parents, you need to do as much work as the child, and maybe even more. And not because you're a bad parent, but first of all, it's Olympic training to raise the kids. So you need to Olympic train yourself to raise your kid in the right way. And then the kid is going to change with you when you change.
Right, right.
So that's, that's so... And I think on the other hand, putting your child in another home, I know that as a mom, that feels like such a failure and such a taboo. And very often, they come in a home, like you have the right environment, Miss B has the right environment, Nancy and... Deborah and the people we know. But if you put them in another foster care or like a place where they don't have the right amount, it doesn't solve the problem.
Well, and it just creates chaos in that home.
Oh.
And one of the, two parents have said this to me in the last 6 months, so I'm going to mention this about when a child is in a respite home. Both of them said to me, but Therese, aren't we traumatizing them more because they're feeling rejected for being placed out of the home? Mm-hmm. And what I tell them is no, absolutely not. And the reason is they are not being rejected by the parents. They are experiencing the consequences of their own behaviors. Okay, so we describe it to them, to the child when they leave the home, that, and there's usually a buildup to this happening, because we'll tell them, well, here's what you're doing. These are all the behaviors that are not family child behaviors, family boy, family girl behaviors. You're doing this, doing this, doing this. Well, we just gave you alternatives to that. You have alternate solutions. You don't have to keep doing those same not a family boy or girl behaviors. You have alternatives now. However, if you continue to do the behaviors that are not family girl behaviors, then you're telling us that you can't handle being in a family right now. And that is okay. It's okay that you can't handle being in a family right now, because we have a place that can help you. By not being a family girl, by not accepting the help that mom and dad are trying to give you, you are telling mom and dad that you need more help than they are able to give you. They brought me in as a therapist. I'm not able to help you because you're not doing your part. We will find you the help you need to be a family girl. So we're not going to make this decision. You're going to make this decision, whether you stay in the home or whether you're going to get more help. So you show us with your behaviors what you need. And again, this goes back to the we address needs, not wants, because no kid wants to go to a respite home. But some kids need to go to a respite home. So you as the child are completely in control of this decision, and you show us what you need. If you need to be with your family, you'll make the right choices, you'll do the right things, and we'll move on from there. If you need to be in a respite home, you will show us that with your choices as well.
It's interesting how you describe it, because when I hear the language that regular caregivers are using, that is almost, there's always like, you're dangerous, you're this. So they say it in such a different way that the child feels even more like a failure and then have to leave the home because he is a failure. I always also tell the parents that you need to learn the trauma. I call it trauma language. And what I hear you're using right now, I would describe as trauma language, because you don't take the child down. You give them responsibility. You give them a choice. And it's so different to approach the children in that way.
Correct.
So thank you for that. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Let me see. We have to, maybe we can do one more question.
Okay.
Let me see. Yeah, this is from a special need teacher, and I think it will also be something that other people who get in contact with traumatized kids will feel. Like, this teacher says, how do I deal with kids that first make really nice contact, they want to approach, they open up, and then they separate from the contact, and they turn to others, and they start gossiping about me. I'm sure that happened to her, and probably touched her personal. I feel like it touched her on the personal level. I would like to hear the do's and don'ts in those situations like this.
Okay, that we call that crazy making. Okay. That child is a crazy maker. Her goal is to instigate and create problems in the environment. So the way you manage that is, number one, you don't give them any information that they do not need to have. Remember, you're not there to be their friend. You are there to guide them through a difficult time in their life, and you have to do that by maintaining the structure of the environment, being the person that they can respect, that they know they need to respect, because you are a step ahead of them all the time. That's the really exhausting part about parenting or teaching these children, is you have to be able to stay a step ahead of them. And a lot of them are so, so, so creative and just go off in places you would never imagine. And you have to be able to beat them to that place. But yeah, I would limit the amount of information that you give them. And when she's caught crazy making, you hold her accountable for that. In this situation where she's gossiping and stirring the pot, I would isolate her, and I would tell her, "Wow, you're making life hard for the group by creating chaos. So we're going to help you with that by helping you learn some self-control with your mouth, because your mouth is running." And so you're going to learn how to control that by spending some time over here by yourself, and you're going to journal about what you did, because we want them to be able to be accountable for what they did. They have to take responsibility and understand what they did wrong in order to change it. They can't change it before they understand it. And journaling is one of the best ways to help them understand.
And with journaling, you mean also like the five questions that we have, like news with the TBI? Yeah.
Yeah, the five questions, and they can't answer with one word answers. They need to write full sentences. This is what happened. This is what I was feeling. This is what I did with this feeling. This is how it worked for me. And this is what I'll do differently the next time.
Yes, yes, yes. Thank you so much. Maybe we could end this interview with having a little talk about the camp, because I think therapeutic attachment camps are the key to, like I said, a quick start with, you know. With
and I tell people that call me on the phone, I don't take insurance over here. So when people work with me, they have to be able to pay for me. And there's just a lot of families that can't afford it. And not that I'm that expensive, but what I tell them is then come to camp. You know, our next camp is March
22nd until 28th.
There you go. Bingo. Thank you.
Hey, I already booked my ticket. I'm going to be there.
Yes. So that gives parents time to save up the money that they need to come to the camp. And what I tell them about camp is the best bang for your buck when it comes to working with children with attachment problems. You will get more in that week than you would get working with me in therapy, because we do 2-hour appointments. You have to learn everything that you're going to learn in camp in order for your kids to be successful. And for me to teach you as a therapist in 2-hour chunks is going to cost you a fortune. Spend the money. Come to camp and you will get your money's worth and so much more than you could get with a therapist, even though you need the therapist for the parts you need them for. But all of this stuff that you learn at camp You're going to have to learn for your child to heal, and this is the most cost-effective way to learn it.
Yeah, and for me, I was there with my family a few years ago. What I found magical, first the place, how magical is your camp?
We're so lucky to have that place. And Stephen are so, they have been with us for the 20 camps now, and they have, our first camp there, it was such a fluke that we ended up there. But they took Nancy's purple book and they studied it before we even arrived so that they knew what was coming into the camp. And it would, they've been just wonderful. I can't say enough.
Yeah, the people working at the camp, like I now I come back every year to contribute and to be there for the other families. But the first year, I didn't know what to expect. And I took my husband with his ears and my son with his ears, like to the camp. They didn't want to be there. And I felt so, yeah, like nervous about it. But after one day, it was like heaven almost. You were there with a whole week of you were there a whole week with other parents. You don't have to feel ashamed. You can talk. You don't have, need to explain anything. And it's so warm and comforting. And when you have like breakouts or with the partner, the husband, or with the kids, everything's fine. And I thought that was so amazing.
Well, and there was a camp that we had, well, it 3 years ago, 2 years ago, 17, this month. And that camp, there was a one of the dads in the camp set up a Zoom group. They, to this day, meet every Tuesday night for an hour to discuss where their families are at, what's where. And it has provided a sense of camaraderie and relationship and just support that you can't get anywhere else. Now, it takes someone in the group to go ahead and set something like that up. But we do have a Facebook page for each and every camp that everyone gets onto. Mm. And that allows for those relationships that are formed at the camp. And the kids don't make relationships. The kids are not going there to find friends.
Exactly.
The parents need that support because they're now in an environment that most have never been in before, where they have 100% support in the chaos that is their lives. Instead of the judgment, the criticism, the trying to explain, and the nobody understanding, it's a week of being in an environment with people that are in the same shoes you are and so totally get what your life is like.
Yeah. It's so beautiful. And people come from all walks of life. I thought that was also amazing. And it was not only people who can afford it very easy. Some people really need to make sacrifices. Some people do crowdfunding.
Crowd sales.
Yeah, they do. And also the team members, like now I'm one of them. But when I came as a family, it was so nice to have the love coming from their eyes. You know, everybody was looking at you and you felt the love and the support that you miss in daily life. Mm-hmm. So
I want to tell you one of the things that, and we only started doing this maybe 3 or 4 years ago, but it's the simplest thing that makes such a difference in the lives of the parents. And what it is the kids are always in the dining hall when the parents come out of the training with Nancy, because every morning there's 3 hours of training with Nancy. And we split the kids into the red bandanas and the blue bandanas. The red bandanas are the kids with RAD or attachment issues. Blue bandanas are the healthy kids. But all the kids are in the dining hall when the parents get done with the training with Nancy. And as they walk from the training room into the dining hall, and this is going to give it away for any of you that do end up for coming to camp. So
be surprised
when it happens. But the parents come in and all the kids are standing up and they start applauding. I get goosebumps just to talk about it. They start applauding the parents as they walk in. And the faces of those parents that are being acknowledged and appreciated by their crazy kids just shift. I mean, it's probably my favorite thing about camp.
Yeah, one of the many favorite things about camp. And I remember also, I'm helping you now for a few years. I remember stories from parents or sentences from parents, like after a few days, I remember, I can't say any names, but he was like 2 feet something. He came at camp at the last moment, and then the mother said, "He's laughing again. He didn't smile for like a year." And I saw him making little cries from his mom. And it's magical what you can reach in such a short time, because the environment and the knowledge and the many years of practice you have, it's like, yeah, it's what I would give. To
Nancy. Nancy's what makes camp what camp
is. She's like the queen, not Miss Beam, but queen of the camp. Yeah. But also like everybody. Everybody's like,
she's the leader, and we all follow faithfully doing what we need to do.
Exactly. I keep coming back every time.
Yeah.
Well, I think we're gonna finish off. Thank you so much. I think it's gonna be very valuable to listen to, and I see you next year.
Yes. Well, it's 3-4 months away. It's coming. That'll be so wonderful. Yeah. We'll have to do this again sometime. I'll be happy to talk whenever it works for you.
Great. I'm going to stop recording, but then I want to say goodbye to you.